I know. Thank you. I'm going to call the meeting of the Ocean Protection Council to order and welcome you all. First, I am going to welcome back the state controller, who in the rotational system with the Lands Commission, we get her for this next year. And she's been a strong leader on coastal and ocean issues and is going to be a valued member of this group. Obviously, with Assemblymember Stone and Secretary Rodriguez, we have a quorum. But we also have remotely Michael Brown, who's at the Bren School in Santa Barbara. And Michael, they tell me you can see us, but we will just, on occasion when you speak up, hear you. So whenever you want to be recognized, let us know. They said it would appear to come on high. So I just want everybody to know that's our member who's in Santa Barbara. And I think that just to briefly frame this meeting, this meeting is really solely for the purpose of considering and adopting our guidance on sea level rise. And as many of you know, this is the culmination of a very long process that existed in the collation of the existing science, in public meetings around the state, in developing this in response to comments from individuals, from NGOs, from local governments to figure out what we should do. And I think the challenge is this is one of the most pressing problems with regard to climate that California is facing. And yet it appears that some of the facts and evidence are changing or being read differently in different times. And so it's really clear that if you can't predict exactly what the rise will be at a certain time, it's definitely rising and it's definitely on that trend. And so the question for us is how to bring everybody along in California in their actions and what to do with this guidance. And the governor was personally briefed the minute this science was available, has been engaged in this, and recognizes its significance as part of his overall climate efforts, but what we have to do. And so today, the Ocean Protection Council staff will go into more of the details of the guidance, and I know there will be some distinguished speakers, and then there'll be us up here. We will have this presented to us, and I hope that this turns into a very useful exercise that communities across California can use. And just in the housekeeping, we'll take public comment after item three, which is the item, and then there's a place to allow for comment on non-agenda items, but this is really a one-agenda meeting. And so at the back of the room, you'll find speaker cards. Fill one out for whatever item you wish to speak. It'll be brought to me, and at the right time when we move ahead, I will recognize you. And where do they take the cards? To that basket or that thing right there? Okay. And public comment is limited to 3 minutes each. We're in a new room, so I don't know if we have exactly the same lighting system that tells you 3 minutes, but we will give you a hint if you get to it. With that, are there any other opening comments from members before we move on? Executive Director's report.
Thank you, Secretary Laird and members of the Council. I am so pleased and excited to bring you the Sea Level Rise Guidance document today. As you know, and as Secretary Laird just mentioned, we have spent over a year on this project. First, we convened a group of world-renowned scientists to analyze and synthesize the most up-to-date, current, and best available science to lay the foundation for our policy guidance. And that analysis was published and presented here last April. That's the Rising Seas Report. The Rising Seas Report included advances in sea level rise modeling and improved understanding of the potential contribution of melting ice sheets in Antarctica and Greenland to rising sea levels. The Rising Seas Report contained 7 key findings. One, as Secretary Laird just mentioned, scientific understanding that sea level rise is advancing at a rapid pace. The direction of sea level rise is clear. They are rising. The rate of ice loss from the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets is increasing, and California is particularly vulnerable to sea level rise caused by ice loss from West Antarctica. New scientific evidence has highlighted the potential for extreme sea level rise. Probabilities of specific sea level increases can inform decision making. Current policy decisions are shaping our coastal future, and waiting for scientific certainty is neither a safe nor a prudent option. So today, using the scientific findings and approaches recommended in Rising Seas, we bring to you a bold and scientifically grounded policy approach to address sea level rise in our state. This kind of bold approach is paramount as we look at the current and anticipated severity of climate change impacts on California's coast and ocean and the implications for the long-term health and sustainability of our coastal communities and marine environment. Sea level rise is an immediate, real threat to our people, our infrastructure, our economy, and our environment, and it requires strong, thoughtful guidance. I want to emphasize that this guidance update should be seen as a living document and that we view adoption of the guidance as one step in a multi-step process. Our work on sea level rise does not by any means end here, and we will continue to work closely with all of our state and local partners to ensure the best possible uptake and implementation. I just want to take one moment now to, which actually merits far more than one moment, but one moment to thank Jen Eckerly and Jen Phillips and Sarah Briley for their tireless work on this guidance document. Without their energy and their commitment, there would be no guidance update. So thank you. It's also my pleasure to introduce our extraordinary speakers today. We invited them to provide you with detailed information regarding the latest science, how broader adaptation work is being performed by the state, local needs and barriers to implementing the guidance, and how to visualize vulnerability and triggers. So our first speaker will be Dr. Robert Kopp. Dr. Kopp is director of the Rutgers Institute of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences and a professor in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Rutgers. He also serves as co-director of Rutgers' Coastal Climate Risk and Resilience Initiative and as a director of the Climate Impact Lab. Professor Kopp's research focuses on understanding uncertainty in past and future climate change, with major emphases on sea level change and the interactions between physical climate change and the economy. So he'll be providing kind of the scientific basis. Dr. Louise Bedsworth is deputy director at the Governor's Office of Planning and Research. And at OPR, Dr. Bedsworth advises on climate science and research and is leading efforts on incorporating climate impacts into state planning and investment. Prior to joining OPR in 2011, she was a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, where she focused on climate action at the local level, adaptation to climate change, and transportation and air quality. Louise has also held positions at the Union of Concerned Scientists and several other institutes, and she has a number of advanced degrees that I'm not going to list here. Dr. Tiffany Wise West is the City of Santa Cruz's Sustainability and Climate Action Manager. A licensed professional civil engineer and lead associate professional, Dr. Wise West has over 20 years of experience in municipal environmental program and project management. Drawing on her interest in innovation and education, she specializes in collaborating across public, private, and academic sectors to deliver award-winning and impactful emissions mitigation and climate adaptation policies. She also serves as a commissioner on the Santa Cruz County Commission on the Environment and is a Central Coast Climate Collaborative Steering Committee member. And you probably are well acquainted with one another. Dr. Juliet Finzi Hart is an oceanographer at USGS's Pacific and Coastal Marine Science Center and serves as the director of outreach for the Climate Impacts and Coastal Processes team. Juliet works to help coastal communities understand and utilize the best available science in their coastal planning. She has a strong focus on developing innovative stakeholder engagement strategies, such as working with citizen scientists and developing virtual and augmented reality applications to help translate complex scientific information. With that, I would like to turn it over to Jen Eckerly, Deputy Director of the Ocean Protection Council, for the staff presentation.
And I would just like to acknowledge we've actually moved to agenda item 3, so and turn it over to you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Laird and members of the council. My name is Jen Eckerly, and I'm your deputy director. And I'm thrilled to be here today to present the update to the State of California Sea Level Rise Guidance for potential adoption. My presentation will begin with a brief overview of the updated guidance, as well as the process undertaken to ensure that it is useful to state and local decisions and based on current science. Before I begin, I would like to thank Secretary Laird and Deborah for their leadership on this issue, and again, acknowledge the hard work of several OPC staff. A huge thanks to Jen Phillips, who was one of the lead authors on the guidance, and to Sarah Briley for her technical expertise in support in helping pull the document together. The updated guidance provides strong science-based methodology to help states and local governments analyze the risks associated with sea level rise and incorporate sea level rise into their planning, permitting, and investment decisions. The guidance provides a synthesis of the best available science on sea level rise projections and rates for California, a step-by-step approach on how to evaluate those projections and related hazard information, and preferred coastal adaptation approaches. It also describes a range of mapping tools available to help decision makers understand the impacts of sea level rise, and you'll hear more about that in Juliet's presentation. Additionally, the guidance will be accompanied by a set of resources, including case studies, funding opportunities, scientific papers, and guidance documents that will help practitioners integrate sea level rise into their decisions. These resources are going to be hosted on the State Adaptation Clearinghouse website and will be released in mid-2018 when the Clearinghouse is publicly launched. Louise will provide more background on this during her presentation. I will provide some details on the guidance in a moment, but first I would like to give some background on how we got here. So what triggered this update? The original sea level rise guidance was developed in 2010 and updated in 2013. This 2018 update was catalyzed by direction from Governor Brown and was warranted by advanced in sea level rise science, as Deborah mentioned, particularly our understanding of ice loss from the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets and the implications of that loss for California's coast. Additionally, it increased policy focus, requiring state and local governments to incorporate climate change into decision making, including Governor Brown's Executive Order B-3015, merited an update to address the needs of both state and local governments. The process to update the guidance included 3 components: updated science, stakeholder engagement, and updating the policy guidance itself. I'm going to walk you through these components quickly. A lot of action going on behind me. the Rising Seas Report, as Deborah just mentioned, and many of you will recall from the April 2016 OPC meeting, we worked closely with a working group of our science advisory team and Ocean Science Trust to develop a state of the science summary of the drivers of sea level rise. This working group of leading sea level rise experts considered recent scientific advances to update the sea level rise projections for California, as provided in the Rising Seas Report. The Rising Seas presents a shift from scenario-based to probabilistic projections and also included an extreme or H++ scenario from ice loss from the West Antarctic ice sheet. And you will hear more about this from Bob in a moment. As Deborah mentioned earlier, the Rising Seas report provided a scientific basis for our guidance update. To better understand the state and local needs associated with sea level rise planning and to ensure that the guidance met those needs, OPC, with assistance from Ocean Science Trust and engagement experts, solicited input from coastal stakeholders, including local, regional, state, and federal agencies, coastal consultants, environmental groups, tribes, and others. One clear message from that outreach was the need for a repository of resources to support planning and implementation efforts. As mentioned earlier, OPC aims to meet this need through the set of resources hosted on the State Adaptation Clearinghouse. The clearinghouse will include those resources that are currently being collected by UC Berkeley's Climate Readiness Institute in an effort funded by OPC to meet the statutory requirement for a statewide sea level rise resource database. As I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, using the Rising Seas Report as our scientific foundation, along from feedback from our extensive outreach, we developed policy guidance that was useful, understandable, and based on best available science. Because localized sea level rise will vary along the coast due to factors like tectonic activity and subsidence, we provided updated sea level rise projections for 12 active tide gauges across the entire California coast. To help guide selection of sea level rise projections and the development of adaptation pathways and contingency plans, we included a stepwise decision framework to help users evaluate the consequence and risk tolerance of various planning decisions. Components of this framework mirror other state guidance, including the Coastal Commission's sea level rise guidance documents and the risk management framework an approach outlined in the state guidebook developed by the Governor's Office of Planning and Research in support of implementation of Executive Order B-3015. You'll hear more about that from Louise. Consistent with the previous guidance, the updated document provides recommended strategies for planning and adaptation approaches with an understanding that the diversity of communities, uses, natural resources along California's coastline, as well as planning for new development versus existing structures, may merit different approaches to building resilience. These strategies include prioritizing protection of vulnerable communities and social equity, protecting coastal habitats and public access, acknowledging the unique characteristics, constraints, and values of water-dependent infrastructure, ports, and public trust uses, considering acute increases in sea level rise caused by king tides, storm surges, and El Nino events, considering the value of cross-jurisdictional coordination and consistency when selecting sea level rise projections, evaluating local conditions, including the diversity of shoreline types, community characteristics, and natural conditions, the importance of building adaptive capacity into project design and planning, and conducting risk assessments and adaptation planning efforts at community and regional scales when possible. Secretary Laird referenced this in his opening remarks, but I want to give a brief overview of the public comment process. A preliminary draft of the guidance was provided to state coastal management agencies and NOAA's Office of Coastal Management comments from that initial review were integrated prior to the public draft being released. The public draft was available for a 30-day public comment period in November. We received approximately 25 public comment letters from state agencies, cities and counties, community groups, tribal representatives, nonprofits, ports, scientists, and engineers. A majority of these comments were incredibly helpful and were integrated into the final version of the guidance. We recognize that adoption of this guidance, should you decide to adopt it today, is a huge step, but it is only the first step in helping ensure that California is prepared for the impending threats associated with sea level rise. Given that there is much work ahead to ensure successful implementation of the guidance, I wanted to take a moment to highlight some next steps focused on outreach to state and local entities and funding opportunities. In the next month or so, we will convene a meeting of the Sea Level Rise Coastal Leadership Team, which includes the State Lands Commission, the Coastal Commission, BCDC, the Coastal Conservancy, and State Parks, along with OPC, to discuss how the guidance will be integrated into coastal agency decisions and existing guidance documents. We will also convene a meeting of the Coast and Ocean Working Group of the State's Climate Action Team, a broader network of agencies which includes the Governor's Office of Emergency Services and the Department of Water Resources. We will conduct working sessions across the state, bringing together state and local partners to discuss needs and barriers to effective sea level rise planning and implementation. We have already had a conversation with the San Francisco Office of the Mayor, the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, and the Port of San Francisco about hosting the first session in the Bay Area. We will leverage the Alliance of Regional Collaboratives for Climate Adaptation, otherwise known as ARCA, and other local or regional groups to ensure effective local implementation and address barriers. Tiffany will provide some additional recommendations on critical next steps from the local perspective, and our other presenters will also provide insights on next steps. Finally, in the coming year, OPC will provide a new round of funding to support adaptation planning and implementation projects that build resiliency to sea level rise in California. Just this morning, Deborah testified before the Assembly Budget Committee in support of a $15 million allocation to OPC in the governor's budget to fund climate adaptation and resilience projects. I want to thank you very much for your time, and with that, I will be pleased to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Bob Kopp.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lard. Thank you, members of the committee. Deborah has already introduced me. I think one thing she didn't mention it, but is the reason I'm here is that I was one of the authors of the Rising Seas report. And so I'm here to provide a little bit of a background on the underlying science that was addressed in this report. So as I'm sure you all are familiar with, when we think of global average sea level change, we're really thinking about two things. One is the ice melting on land, flowing into the ocean, increasing the amount of water in the ocean. The other is the ocean taking up heat and expanding as it does so. There's also a third contributor that has to do with changes in the amount of water stored on land and in its liquid form that is associated with groundwater withdrawal in dam construction. If we look over the last 20 years or so, roughly half of the rise in sea level we see in the global average is due to these changes in ice on land at the poles and in mountain glaciers. About 40% is due to changes in the amount of heat in the ocean, and about 10% is due to the net effect of pumping groundwater. But the challenge that faced the committee and that faces anybody who's trying to use sea level rise information for local planning is that nobody lives at the global average. Everybody lives somewhere. And we're not interested in global average sea level change. We're interested in sea level change in San Francisco or Santa Barbara or San Diego. And when we get to that level of detail, there's many more complicating factors that have to be considered. So we're not only concerned about how much heat is in the ocean, but how ocean currents and winds are changing and interact, leading to what we call changes in dynamic sea level. We're not only concerned about changes in the amount of ice on land, but where that ice is melting, because different sources of ice give rise to different patterns of sea level rise associated with the way they change the gravitational field of the Earth and the rotation of the Earth and cause the crust to bend underneath their weight. And then on top of that, we also have changes in the height of the land that have to do with factors ranging from the ongoing response to the end of the last ice age to the motion of plates, which is an important process here in California, to compaction of sediment under their own weight and compaction of sediments enhanced by pumping of groundwater. So all of those are the sorts of factors you have to take into account. And these processes are detailed in the Rising Seas report in the context of California. Just a couple of quick examples. These maps here are showing you how North America, which come from the U.S. government's Climate Science Special Report released late last year, show you how sea level along U.S. coastlines are affected by changes in the ice sheet. So the way to look at here is we're looking at these four different sources of ice: Greenland, the West Antarctic, the East Antarctic, and mountain glaciers. And the areas that are in various shades of orange experience less sea level rise than the global average in response to a melting ice sheet. So for instance, if we're in New Jersey, or even to some extent here in California, we experience less than the global average of sea level rise from Greenland. On the other hand, the areas that are in red are areas where we experience more than global average sea level rise. So along the coast of the United States, if West Antarctica melts, as it's doing, we experience about 30% more sea level rise than the global average. And so that's why it's important when you do sea level rise projections to be thinking not just about the global average, but what are the factors that are causing it to change, and also why we are particularly concerned about some of what we're learning about the potential instability of ice in Antarctica. Another important factor is the motion of land. Jen mentioned that in her presentation. This map here, again, from the U.S. government's Climate Science Special Report, is showing you sort of long-term average rates of change from land motion. In most of California, this is a small factor compared to what we might see in parts of the East Coast or the Gulf Coast, but there's a fair degree of variability at a resolution smaller than you see here. And even within specific areas, say within the city of San Francisco, there is variability in subsidence. And so it's important when you take the sea level rise projections to think about that local context as well. So then to get to the framework that we're using for projections. The first thing to recognize is that particularly for long-term projections after 2050 or so, the largest source of uncertainty is not the physics of the ice sheet, it's the uncertainty in human behavior and economics and technology and policy. And so to do sea level rise projections, we can't just come up with sea level rise projections independent of those sorts of developments. We have to make them conditional upon different pathways. So in the Rising Seas Report and in other work we've done, we've drawn upon a set of projections developed by the climate science community. Formally, they're called the representative concentration pathways, but I'm just going to call them a high emission scenario, that red one, which leads to a doubling of carbon dioxide emissions between 2016 and 2050 and continued growth thereafter. Probably higher than is plausible given the sorts of market-driven transitions we're seeing now, but certainly within the range of possibility. The middle trajectory with a plateauing of emissions, which is perhaps a little closer to the direction we're heading now, but starting from a lower base. So right now we're at 41 billion tons of carbon dioxide a year. That middle one sees emissions slowly growing towards that level by the middle of the century and then decline. And then a low emissions run, beginning with an immediate decline in global carbon dioxide concentrations, leading to net zero emissions in 2080 and negative emissions thereafter. And it's this lowest one, which we'll call the low emission scenario, that is most consistent with the long-term goals set out in the Paris Climate Agreement, which is to limit warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius and to have net zero greenhouse gas emissions sometime in the second half of this century. So in the Rising Seas Report, we focus on that upper scenario and that lower scenario with high emissions and low emissions, which we use to bound the range of sea level rise projections and human factors controlling those. So the framework used to produce the core of the sea level rise projections is a probabilistic framework, as Jen mentioned, and one that's been used by many different stakeholders over the last several years. It's one that we developed at Rutgers in collaboration with colleagues at a variety of institutions and builds off both the work of the New York City Panel on Climate Change in 2013 and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN assessment body. And the basic idea is fairly straightforward. It involves tabulating the individual components that drive sea level change and trying to come up with estimates based on a variety of sources of evidence of the range of both likely and plausible but less likely changes in each of these components. So this flowchart here is highlighting for you changes in the amount of water stored on land, changes in ice sheets, changes in mountain glaciers, changes in the thermal expansion of the ocean, changes in the dynamics of the ocean, and changes in what we're calling non-climatic background processes due to things like plate motion and response to the end of the last ice age. So I'm not going to go through these in detail, but I will say that this resembles, broadly speaking, the sort of assessment approach used by bodies like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change with a couple of added features. So one, we've tried to develop a framework that allows us to consider high-end outcomes in the same framework as most likely outcomes. If you go to the IPCC, they're only going to tell you about the range that they call likely, which has about a 2 in 3 chance, and they won't tell you about things that are outside that range. And that's not necessarily the most useful approach to take for risk management. You might want to know what a 1 in 20 chance or 1 in 100 chance worst case is. And the second is that we've done this in a way that allows us to produce simultaneously sort of the global projections and the local projections. So we're producing these consistently. And as I mentioned, this approach has been used by a variety of stakeholders. It's been used in the Congressional Budget Office's report on hurricane and sea level rise risk. We used it for a report for the New Jersey Climate Adaptation Alliance. It's been used in the 4th National Climate Assessment. It's used, obviously, in rising seas, in the Oregon sea level rise assessment, and local reports in Washington and Boston, and more recently in state-level work in Massachusetts. And so I'm going to focus on San Francisco as one example, but as Jen mentioned, there are projections in the report for 12 tide gauges along the California coast. And so this figure here is showing you the projections based on that sort of core probabilistic framework used here. So we're looking at those three different emission scenarios. We're looking at relative sea level change, so that means local sea level change in San Francisco in feet above a 2000 average. The lines are showing you the median or 50th percentile projection. And those bars on the end are showing you the 90th percentile, 9 and 10 chance projection for the end of the century. And so you can see that there's a reasonable range of a couple of feet in that 90 percentile range, and there's an increase with amount of emissions. Now, we should emphasize that this is an approach for accumulating evidence. It's one scientifically justifiable estimate of future sea level rise, and based upon science, we've developed it in a way that's consistent with the fifth assessment report of the IPCC, and the global projections are further supported by a study we did a couple of years ago looking at the relationship between temperature and rate of sea level change over the last 2,000 years. So these projections are consistent with what you would expect if the relationship between temperature and sea level stayed the same as it has been for the last two millennia. But there's no guarantee that the past is a good guide to the future. We are pushing the climate system outside the range that it has experienced over the last several thousand years. Indeed, we're pushing carbon dioxide concentrations to levels they have not experienced in several million years. And meanwhile, we are learning a lot about what we don't know about how ice sheets may respond to a radically warmer climate. This photo here that I'm showing you is a photo taken by a collaborator, Knut Christensen, at the University of Washington, of Helheim Glacier in Greenland. And I'm showing it to illustrate one sort of setup that can give rise to an instability in an ice sheet. So here what you're seeing is a massive cliff of ice, a couple hundred feet in height, that is capable of collapsing under its own weight. And when you get this process in motion, you can get this collapse that leads to a very rapid retreat at a rate of miles per year. And so we're learning more, as a scientific community as a whole, about the potential for modes of instability like this ice cliff collapse, as well as other modes of instability, to drive significantly higher rates of sea level rise, particularly in areas like West Antarctica, where much of the ice sheet sits below sea level. So I'm going to show you a sea level rise projections from a study that came out late last year that we led that came out after the Rising Seas report but was informed by that same body of knowledge and looked at the effect of substituting in some new projections involving the West Antarctic ice sheet and the East Antarctic ice sheet into the same sea level rise framework. So we're going to look at the effect of one projection on the cutting edge of science of Antarctic ice sheet change on these overall sea level rise projections here in San Francisco. So these are the same projections I showed you before, but the scale has changed. So instead of 0 to 5 feet, we're now looking at 0 to 9 feet on that vertical axis. And what I'm going to show you next is what happens when you substitute these alternative projections of Antarctic ice sheet change. So I'm going to suggest that you look at 2050 and 2100, and that you also try to take in the difference between those different emission scenarios. So I'm going to flip back and forth a couple of times. So first, if you look at those 2050 projections, you can see that there's not a huge amount of change there, right? So what we're learning is largely a concern about changes later in the second half, in the second half of the century, and probably not a large process in play for the next 30 years. Now, if you look at the end of the century, In particular, if you look at the bars, what you can see is that the effect of some of these modes of instability are largest under the higher emission scenarios and can be quite dramatic under the highest emission scenario. Right, so we're going from something like 2 to 4 feet to something like more like 4 to 8 feet under that high emission scenario if you take this one study on the cutting edge of ice sheet, of Antarctic ice sheet modeling. Now, it's one study, and you wouldn't want your sea level rise projections to be buffeted by every single new study that comes out. But this study that we incorporated here does highlight some new processes that haven't previously been incorporated into modeling studies. And it's one of several lines of evidence that led the Fourth National Climate Assessment Team to conclude that there's a physically plausible case, although of uncertain probability, to be made for sea level rise on the global average of as much as 8 feet, what they call their extreme sea level rise scenario. And that extreme sea level rise scenario is what led to the H++ or high +++ scenario. It's terminology that came out of a UK study in the Rising Seas report. So this figure here is from the Rising Seas report and is showing you the two probabilistic projections I showed you earlier and this extreme scenario. Now, when thinking about the extreme scenario, it's important to keep in mind that those processes we talked about probably don't kick in until the second half of the century. So this is not really a concern for the next 30 years, but it sort of demarcates current estimates of the upper edge of the plausible, or at least of the physically plausible, for the second half of the century. So it demarcates a range that has to be considered. So a few key points about this. One, in a high emissions future, sea level rise could be considerably larger than the IPCC's fifth assessment report and those core probabilistic projections suggest. But there is a great deal of what practitioners in this field call deep uncertainty in sea level rise projections after 2050, and that deep uncertainty is deepest when we're looking at high emissions futures. Moreover, because those processes don't really kick in until the second half of the century, large-scale measurements like global average sea level change or the aggregate amount of ice loss from Antarctica won't be able to distinguish between whether we're at the low end of projections or the high end of projections until the second half of the century. We need to get more fundamental advances in physical understanding to be able to move that distinction point earlier. Nonetheless, these results do suggest that meeting the global long-term goals set out in the Paris Agreement, well below 2 degrees Celsius net zero greenhouse gas emissions sometime in the second half of this century, would make these lower scenarios significantly more likely than scenarios leading to 6 feet or more. And this deep uncertainty points to the need for flexible and robust adaptation strategies that include recognizing the areas where we have more robust projections the next 30 years and contingency planning for the variety of possible futures beyond that. And that's represented in step 5 of the guidance document. More generally, I think it's important to recognize that in many contexts, planners and risk analysis are just beginning to incorporate sea level rise projections into decisions in a way that actually leads to real differences in outcomes. And what works and doesn't work is in this context itself a cutting-edge research question in the area of decision and social science rather than natural science. And given that, and given the uncertainty, iteration among and co-production of knowledge involving physical scientists, decision scientists, state decision makers, and local decision makers is really key to moving forward. And California has the opportunity, as it does this, to really be on the cutting edge, not just in terms of policy, but in the understanding of what works in terms of policy. Thank you.
Thank you. And since we have a number of 4 speakers, I think the way we're going to do it is hold questions until we've heard from everyone and the members of the public and then bring it back for questions. So,
great. Thank you all. Good afternoon. Louise Bedsworth from OPR. And that's a tough act to follow. So I'm going to talk really about basically how the sea level rise guidance supports our ongoing state adaptation and resilience work we're doing at the state level, but also with local governments as well. And so I will really pretty briefly walk through 3 major areas where we've been coordinating and working with OPC and where this guidance in particular really fits in. I'll first talk about Executive Order B3015 implementation. They'll talk about our new general plan guidelines, and then finally the Integrated Climate Adaptation and Resiliency Program and the implementation of Assembly Bill 2516. And so I'll start with Executive Order B3015, which was signed in April of 2015 by Governor Brown and established our 2030 greenhouse gas emission reduction target, but also included a set of pretty robust steps on climate adaptation. And one of those was that state agencies should integrate climate change into all planning and investment, including in the state's five-year infrastructure plan. This directed OPR to form a technical advisory group to provide guidance on how to implement the directions in the executive order. So we approached this technical advisory group around building resilience really thinking about two dimensions of what we need to be doing. One is clearly we need to be planning for a different future. We have changing climate conditions. It's affecting both our average experience and then the frequency and severity of extreme events. And so that is clearly one piece that we've been thinking a lot about. I think the other really important piece that we integrated into this is the fact that we need to be planning differently. Things are uncertain, information is emerging, and so we need to be building flexibility into planning in ways we haven't really before. And this points to things like an adaptation pathways approach, but also really thinking in a multi-attribute way and using systems thinking in how we approach planning. And so we looked at it to a sort of risk-based decision-making framework very similar to what's employed in the sea level rise guidance document. We did finalize and finally release from that process a guidance document. The technical advisory group met for about a year, 2016 into 2017. We considered thinking about scenarios, so what climate futures are we planning for, but we also had groups focused on community development and equity, infrastructure, both gray and green, and then metrics in terms of how do we track our progress. And our guidebook points to a four-step process. It's quite high level because it's really intended to cover the whole gamut of state activities and also meet state agencies where they are, some of whom are quite advanced on climate adaptation planning and some who are just barely thinking about it. But probably most importantly for the conversation here today, for sea level rise guidance, we say look to OPC and their sea level rise guidance document to do that. But I think we see also a lot of similarities around even looking at other climate impacts for the near term between now and 2050, looking at pretty much a high emission scenario because we don't see that divergence until later in the century, and then providing a similar risk-based approach for how we think about conditions in the latter part of the century. So next I'll talk about the general plan guidelines. Toward the end of last year, we finalized a very comprehensive update to the general plan guidelines. It was actually the first comprehensive update for all elements in over a decade. And one of our goals in doing that was to integrate climate change considerations throughout the document alongside equity and economic development. While we were in the midst of the update, Senate Bill 379 was passed, which directed local governments to integrate climate change risk into the safety element of their general plan. And so that really created a local audience in legislation for the OPC sea level rise guidance document, and was another factor. We started working quite early with OPC on how we broaden that the document to address a local audience. Throughout the development of the general plan guidelines, we also worked very closely with the Coastal Commission and others because we're trying to look at alignment across local plans. So not just general plans, but local coastal programs, local hazard mitigation plans. And so again, the OPC guidance is going to provide a really critical, consistent tool to be used across across those efforts. And so finally, I'll talk about the work we've been doing through the Integrated Climate Adaptation and Resiliency Program. For folks who are not familiar with that, in 2015, Senator Wieckowski authored Senate Bill 246, which created the Integrated Climate Adaptation and Resiliency Program within OPR. And this is really a program focused on coordinations across state, local, regional, and tribal activities with a focus on implementation of adaptation activities on the ground. We are really trying to approach to support an integrated approach to climate change, to really thinking about mitigation and adaptation together, and advancing equity and environmental justice in doing this work. There are two main components to the program, and I'm going to talk mostly about the Adaptation Clearinghouse, which Jen mentioned, but the other piece is that we have a technical advisory council, which is made up of local, regional, private sector, and NGO members, as well as state agency members, that meets quarterly, and it is a public process, a public open meeting. And we have used that council, both Jen and Deborah have participated in that process and used the council as another venue for feedback on and to receive updates on the sea level rise guidance. But I will talk more about the clearinghouse because this has actually been a pretty great area of collaboration where I think we all sat down and said, well, we're all trying to do similar things. How can we work together and try to create a better product to support local planning? And so basically the Adaptation Clearinghouse is primarily geared towards local jurisdictions and practitioners to help inform how to do things on the ground. And the intention is for it to be a searchable database of resources, resources including access to data, other plans, case studies, and just a whole range of different resources. And it's searchable in a variety of ways. We can look by tags, by topics, which are aligned with the Safeguarding California plan. We also have a map interface, so you could point to a jurisdiction and see what is available in that area. And then we have some case studies and then tools and data sets. We have fully integrated this with the AB 2516 Sea Level Rise database. So Assembly Bill 2516 was passed in 2014 and directed OPC and the Natural Resources Agency to conduct biannual surveys of sea level rise planning information. And so they have been working with the Climate Readiness Institute at UC Berkeley to build a collection of resources to support sea level rise planning. And so we've been working to integrate all of those resources into the clearinghouse. And so as of March 5th, 2018, I should say the clearinghouse is currently in beta form. You can actually, if you go to resilientca.org, you'll get a little warning box, but you could see it in its current in-process state. And we'd welcome that and some feedback if folks are interested. But in there right now, we have 153. We have a total of just almost 430 resources that we at OPR have been developing. But of those, 153 were developed by CRI as part of AB 2516. And then we have some additional ocean and coastal resources that brings the number to almost 200 that are currently in the clearinghouse. And this will continue to grow as more information is collected over time and will remain a living resource so that it stays current and up to date. So just to give you a sense of what it what it looks like, I mentioned this, I show this primarily because one, this was developed by the Geographic Information Facility at UC Berkeley, and they also developed the CalAdapt resource that the Energy Commission has developed to make climate data and information available. And we did that intentionally to have a similar look and feel and also to have seamless integration and access to that those data and really try to create a system of resources that would be available to jurisdictions. And so the clearinghouse, this is the landing page for the clearinghouse, and you can see different resources and search for the resources within it. Again, you can look by topic, all of these, and hopefully Secretary Laird recognizes these lovely icons that come straight from Safeguarding California, again, trying to create a lot of consistency across our work. You can search by topic. And then, so for each topic, there is a page. And so this is the page that we developed with the Ocean Protection Council on coasts and oceans that is currently in the clearinghouse. And so you can go to this, and you will see various resources that are available. And then when you look at the resources, it will look like this, but there are a series of filters, and this is, again, everything is really under refinement and in development, but a series of resources so that you can, or a series of filters, so you look at these resources, you could say, well, I really just want to look at case studies, or I want to look at information that's about how to communicate and educate in this topic. And so all of this is available. And as I said, you can start playing around with it now. We'll actually be doing some formal beta testing starting later this month. And again, this is just the filters that you can use. And so with that, I think I will conclude there. But I think we are all have really, one, appreciated working with OPC on this effort, and I think it's going to be really instrumental in supporting the work that we're doing and implementing our adaptation work. So thank you.
Thank you.
So good afternoon, Chair Laird, council members. It's my honor and I'm truly pleased to be here today to share with you what we're doing in Santa Cruz in terms of climate adaptation and how that aligns with or maybe doesn't align with the new guidance that's coming out. I am the Sustainability and Climate Action Manager. Our Climate Action Program is in its 10th year this year. And in this role, not only do I work on climate adaptation, but the other half of my time is spent on emissions mitigation. So really, it's been interesting in the past year and a half, adaptation has really kind of overtaken emissions mitigation in terms of the amount of time and effort that we spend on this. And I have to say I'm very fortunate to work with many community partners, scientists, and other advisors, as well as our departments and teams within the city on achieving our climate action goals. I thought the first thing I would share with you is our climate hazards, and I know we're really focused on sea level rise here at this meeting, but you know, our sea level rise impacts our increased erosion, rising tides, and coastal storm flooding, as well as a couple other impacts that we're monitoring. And of course, we're nestled against the Santa Cruz Mountains and have some quite a bit of open space in Santa Cruz, so wildfire is certainly a threat. Also, increased severity and frequency of weather events can also have the potential to increase landslides. Increased temperature can also affect food and fuel availability. And last, we have impacts to ecosystems and habitats, as well as potential for drought. So just to run through our adaptation work to date, we really started with our first vulnerability assessment in 2011 that was conducted by Dr. Gary Griggs and Brent Haddad at UC Santa Cruz, where we really started to get an understanding of what our impacts were and how we could move forward with some recommendations. That became part of our climate adaptation plan that was subsequently developed. That adaptation plan was the first that we had completed. It unfolded as an appendix to our local hazard mitigation plan. And although it was a separate document, it also went together with the LHMP to Cal OES and FEMA for approval, which it gained and was adopted by our city council in 2012. Fast forward ahead some time with a little bit of work done from that climate adaptation plan and the recommendations contained in it. Fast forward to 2016 and we realize, okay, we need to, we know that there's new science out there available. We need to conduct a sea level rise vulnerability assessment. And so we did so. We contracted with a Central Coast Wetlands group to do so. And I'll talk more about that in just a moment and show you some of the maps. We also completed last year a social vulnerability to climate change assessment, which I'm very excited to share with you as well. So getting into the sea level rise vulnerability assessment. So because of the timing of when we did our sea level rise vulnerability assessment and the timing of the guidance document coming out, our sea level rise vulnerability assessment is scenario-based, not probabilistic. And, you know, we understand that that doesn't really comply with the latest guidance, and we will be working if we can secure some resources and capacity to do an update, but this is what we have right now that really has given us a much better temporal and spatial understanding of what our impacts look like. And so here is the mapping. So again, this is based on the Natural Resource Council's sea level rise projections and mapping by ESA. And we did, what you're looking at here is anything that's blue as you kind of come inland from the shoreline are our projected combined coastal climate change hazard zones. And they're projected out through 2100. So the lighter the blue color, the further out is what you're looking at here. In terms of coastal hazards, you know, we have a pretty good understanding of what's happening here. We have erosion on West Cliff and East Cliff. We have increased flooding down in our beach flats area, which is in that center blue area and main beach. We have increased potential of flooding over at our harbor, which is on the right, and Natural Bridges, one of our parks, over on the left-hand side. Now, what I'm showing you here is under the scenario, under the assumption that our protective structures, so that would be levees, pumps, and seawalls, would hold. And this is what we're projecting it would look like if those protective structures would fail. And you see a lot more flooding inundation inland and increased flooding and erosion in some of those other areas that I've mentioned here. As far as the H++ projection is concerned, because we didn't do, we did this scenario-based analysis with the older information, how we've addressed H++ in our adaptation planning, the plan itself, and in our outreach, is that we say, in terms of these coastal hazards, we have a pretty good understanding of what's going to happen. It's really just a matter of when. And so, you know, when we're in the community, we acknowledge H++. We haven't modeled it, but really, if we are on a high emissions trajectory, it will only cause these impacts to come sooner. In terms of our social vulnerability assessment, one last thing I wanted to mention before I move on is that we did also determine the valuation of infrastructure and property that is located within these hazard zones and identified as vulnerable. And through year 2060, we're in today's dollars, we are projecting about $170 million worth of infrastructure and property is vulnerable by year 2060. So getting back to the social vulnerability assessment, this is a GIS-based assessment that we did with Dr. Giuliano Khalil. We were very fortunate to be connected with him through the American Geophysicists Union's Thriving Earth Exchange and worked with him on this at no cost. What we did is built by Census Block Group a social vulnerability score based on five drivers, and here's what that looks like. So by census block group here, the more red the block, the higher the social vulnerability. On the left-hand side, then, you're seeing the different scores of social vulnerability by census block overlaid with our coastal climate hazards. On the right-hand side, you see the same thing overlaid with our 2030 wildfire hazards. What this does is allows us, based on the drivers of social vulnerability in these areas, to customize or tailor adaptation strategies to be more effective. I'll give you a really simple example. Down in our beach flats area, which is on the left-hand side, down where our wharf is, the red area where you can also see blue on top of it, we know down there, thank you for whoever's using the pointer, We know that social vulnerability is largely driven by English not spoken as a first language, and so we're providing information on flooding response, any other kind of acute response, both in English and in Spanish in our reverse 911 calls and our materials going out in the community. That's just one simple example, and we're really starting to just scratch the surface on the utility of this social vulnerability assessment, but we're very happy that we're able to get at that social equity piece that's called out in the guidance through this social vulnerability assessment. Continuing on, so both of these assessments have been incorporated into our draft climate adaptation plan update that was completed in 2017. Right now, it's out to FEMA. It's already gone through Cal OES, and we've received comments. Again, it's packaged with the local hazard mitigation plan, and we anticipate it to be adopted in 2018. We did submit this to the Coastal Commission for review and are incorporating their comments, which largely revolve around needing to provide some supplemental information on coastal access. We also recognize that the plan, you know, it has varying levels of treatment for different hazards. We did use CalADAPT to update our impacts to the extent we could, but we know that we need to bolster areas such as habitat, which we're really looking forward to the Nature Conservancy's tool that will be coming out later this year to help with that, as well as cultural resources and a couple other items. And so we are working in the community to ensure that that gets incorporated into the adaptation plan. The adaptation plan contains 41 actions that are prioritized. They range from infrastructure, both hard and soft, or green infrastructure, to policy, such as consideration of managed retreat or elevating development, to education. And if you can see this, I know this is really hard, but on A1, our number one strategy was to increase public awareness and education. And so we are really taking that to heart. And I'll talk more about that, our outreach campaign, in just a moment. At the same time as developing the adaptation plan update, we also initiated our local coastal program to update it with sea level rise policies. We have had some turnover in our advanced planning division of our planning department, and this has stalled a bit, but I'm anticipating that an administrative draft will be submitted to the Coastal Commission later this year. We have also begun some ad hoc monitoring, installing some water level sensors at our river mouth, and I'm working with the county on potentially bringing a tidal gauge to Santa Cruz, to the harbor, or to the wharf. And next, we are halfway through a 9-month climate adaptation outreach campaign. We are out in the community. We have over 50 events that we've been doing, anything that ranges from Spanish language story time to Meals on Wheels tabling to community forums, coastal restoration work days, and awareness walks. And you can see here, we really are striving to place a lot of that outreach in our vulnerable populations. And you can see by this pie wedge that 20% of our events are either targeted to or in socially vulnerable communities. And as we continue with this outreach, we are making more connections and being able to kind of get deeper into those communities, which is something I'm really excited about. I just wanted to give you a flavor for some of the things that we ask for or ask about in our adaptation forums. You know, we start with how do we get shared values? And, you know, we ask everyone, this is using some live cell phone polling, what do you love or what's your favorite thing about Santa Cruz? And, of course, these mostly revolve around the natural environment and our community.
Avocados?
Absolutely. Okay. It's Santa Cruz, right? Keep Santa Cruz weird. And, you know, what we say about this is what's in common with all these things? They're all impacted by sea level rise. So that's a way to get us all on the same page and have a shared value about why we need to address this. I also worked with a nonviolent communication specialist on, hey, how can we really engage folks? And he said, you know, you need to give space for people to express their feelings about this information that you're delivering to them. And so that's what this question gets to. And, you know, the feelings are very concerned. But we do see some motivation and some activation noted as well, which is really encouraging. And I'm hoping that through our outreach campaign and the engagement we're doing, we're going to see more of those kinds of responses. And then we turn to solutions in our forums, and we look at three different areas in Santa Cruz. I'm just giving you one: Westcliff Drive, We run through what the impacts are, what they're projected to be, and what are some solutions that we can consider, and what are the trade-offs of those solutions. And here's some of the sample responses that we get. This is just one group that we polled, but they have a preference towards a managed retreat policy on the coast. I'm really looking forward to kind of next steps in developing a community vision for coastal management, climate resilient coastal management, in some of our next steps. To round things out, in terms of cross-jurisdictional coordination, we do have a lot going on. I am a steering committee member of the Central Coast Climate Collaborative, which runs from Santa Cruz County down to Ventura County. That group just launched last year and was fortunate to get a technical assistance grant from FEMA and EPA to develop a tailored local government toolkit for climate resilience that will be launched at a workshop in April of this year. The local arm in our area for 4C is the Monterey Bay Regional Climate Action Compact, where next week I'm going to be talking about these efforts that we're doing at 4C, and we'll be looking at some kind of sub-regional actions as well as collaboration across the region. And that is, I should say, for the 4C workshop, one of the prime goals that we have is trying to identify some regional projects of high importance. And finally, we work really closely with the County of Santa Cruz. I'm on the County Commission on the Environment, which is really beneficial in that regard. I mentioned the tidal gauge, but we're also looking at working with them to, again, build this community vision for how we want the coast managed. And we're looking at funding opportunities that we are going to take on together. And as I've already mentioned, we have so many community partners that help us with this work, some in this room, which we're so appreciative. In terms of key challenges that we face and what I hear from other jurisdictions through 4C and other work that I do is that really the funding is crucial here. The funding to do the analysis, the planning, and the outreach, and then, of course, implementation. I'm really encouraged by the grant opportunities that have been available and what I'm hearing from OPC and others about what will be coming out. It is a challenge to find capacity to pursue those grants, but it's something that those community partners really help us with. It can be challenging also to coordinate this work across departments and sectors, maybe with folks I know in our 4C region who don't have political buy-in to this kind of work. It can be challenging, although it seems like things are really getting better, staying abreast of legislation, guidance, and policy requirements. And OPC, ARCA, and others do a great job with webinars that deliver that information very accessibly. And I encourage your staff to continue to get really in-depth into the how-to meet of, you know, complying with SB 379 and so forth. And then the other piece that we're kind of noticing through ARCA is that we really need to engage local and regional champions of this work. I mean, we do have some local champions in the room here, but I'm talking a little more broadly in the region to really try to kind of overcome that other challenge that I mentioned about coordinating across sectors and departments. So that's something else that I really encourage folks to think about. I know my time is up here. What's next for us? We have a lot of technical analyses that we need to do yet. We are looking to expand our outreach to a virtual reality type platform, which we think will really help us with not only improving participation, awareness, and awareness to action, but can also lend itself really well to some research questions. Cost-benefit analyses, super important to make our case for some of these adaptation strategies, particularly green infrastructure. Again, I've already talked about the LCP and the safety element that needs to be completed and will probably be done within the next year to 2 years. Establishing the monitoring program metrics, thresholds, and triggers, I think, is something as a region we need to do, and we're just starting to look at. The one last thing that I'll mention is with respect on the very localized level, how do we ensure that every decision on a policy program or project is made through a climate resilient lens? And we've identified that if we can put on our staff reports, which currently have a background analysis and fiscal impact section, If we can put a climate change impact section on our staff reports, the staff reports are what go to City Council on anything that comes in front of them. It will force them to think about these kinds of things in all their decision making. And I'll be reporting to City Council annually on progress starting in April. With that, I think I'm finished. Please go and like us on Facebook. We're on there. We like to communicate with people. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
So Louise had one hard act to follow, and now I have three. So thank you, including Louise. So I'm Juliette Hart. I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey, with the Pacific Coastal Marine Science Center based in Santa Cruz. I don't have the privilege of living in Santa Cruz. I'm down in Los Angeles. But thank you.
It is a privilege to live in Los Angeles.
Okay. I think so, too, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're outnumbered, so yeah. Thank you. No, I know. I hear it. So that's a whole other session that we can have a discussion on, but yes, I agree.
Keep going.
Yes. So I'm speaking on behalf of the team at USGS, and all of the folks are listed below me, but thank you so much for the opportunity to speak here. Thank you, Deborah and Jen and Jen, for the opportunity to present. And what I'm going to be talking about is all of the information that's available to visualize a lot of what we've been talking about today. And a special thanks, of course, to OPC because you have funded some of the work that I'm going to be talking about towards the end of the presentation. So as a way to thank you, I've memorized the entire OPC guidance. So if you'll turn to page 34, no, I'm just kidding. So what I'm going to be talking about is all these tools that are actually, they are actually outlined on page 34, but are these different tools that are currently available. And so I'm going to kind of talk quickly through the first four on there and then focus a little bit more onto the tool that my team works with, which is the COSMOS tool. So, of course, everyone is familiar with CalAdapt. I won't spend too much time on that, but there's a wealth of information and resources available on there. The sea level rise information is being filled in as we go. I understand that there's some efforts to get some funding to bring all of the fourth assessment work that's been going on to make that accessible. So I think everyone here is very familiar with CalAdapt. There's also the NOAA Sea Level Rise Viewer. This has been in existence for a while, and they're now on 2.0. And this is a really valuable resource. It's actually national in scale, but they have the specific projections for every state. And one of the things that's really cool about the latest version of it is that they have this, you won't see where I click, so I'll just talk you through it. But you see the little yellow thing on the side that says local scenarios. And what they've done now is built in this cool tool where you can pick one of the tide gauges, and then look at the different projections and how those are tied to the probabilistic curves. So the basis for their work is the NOAA projections, but they're very closely tied to what we have in California. So this is a really neat way to be able to explore some of the projections that are in the Rising Seas report. They also have social vulnerability. They have information about marsh migration, levee overtopping, lots of really good, valuable information that is available to the entire state through the NOAA Sea Level Rise Viewer. The other national scale product that's available is the Climate Central Surging Seas. They also are on 2.0. I guess they're like the Spinal Tap because they don't quite go to 11, they go to 10. So this is one way to where you can look at the H++ scenario and see this 10 feet. The NOAA Sea Level Rise Viewer will have that imminently, but this is one place where you can go right now to look at what this will look like. So I'm sort of tried to pick on different parts of the coast as I show some of these projections so no one feels left out. Along with the Climate Central, they also have some social vulnerability information on there. And there's just a wealth of, Climate Central does an incredible job of communicating some of the, beyond just sea level rise, but a lot of the climate information that we are all trying to consume and use in our work. And then, of course, there's the Nature Conservancy. They have the Coastal Resilience Viewer. They started in New York back in, I think, 2011, and then now have been active all over California. Here I'm showing some results from Ventura. What they add onto the scene is also looking at coastal erosion, and then they have some flood and storm projections on top of it. The science underpinning the Coastal Resilience Viewer is from ESA, so really strong information that's available through the Coastal Resilience Viewer as well. So there's a huge basis of information that communities can turn to look to sea level rise information, erosion, and then some of the socioeconomic impacts around those. So when we're thinking about sea level rise, so you have your beautiful house on the beach, and this is a graphic that was developed for the San Diego Report several years back. San Diego, I think it's like San Diego 2050 is calling or something like that. And it was developed by the Climate Education Partners, which was an NSF-funded study that focused on how to communicate climate change. And what I love about it is that it just simplifies what we're dealing with. So if you are... We're in the blue, that's today, there's current sea level. We all know this when we go out in the wintertime because of storms or whatever it may be, you have water further up onto the coast or when it's a high tide. So if you're only thinking about sea level rise, you're only getting about half of the story. If you're a community that's planning for the future, you have your community on the beach, and if you're only looking at sea level rise, you might think that you're in pretty good shape, but if you're not also thinking about storms and tides on top of it, you're missing some of the vulnerability. So this is looking at, we've been doing some work with a really cool camera from Google that does high resolution 3D 360 videos, so you can get really immersed. This is a screenshot from the YouTube video where you can go and see all these, but this is in Long Beach looking at Belmont Shore. This is the normal high tide. And then, I'm gonna represent, don't worry. So this spot probably very well, but so this is looking at the king tide. So we have lots of these visual representations of the future already today, and so we already know the tides are a significant thing that we're going to have to start planning for as the sea rises. This is now old. 2014 Hurricane Marie, this was a hurricane that didn't make landfall here, it was offshore, but the waves and the surge that came with it, this was out on Catalina, was enough to cause some damage. So thinking about just sea level rise by itself is one part of the story, but we also need to be thinking about the broader context of also storms and tides on top of it. So that's what we do at our team at USGS with the Coastal Storm Modeling System. So what we do is we take global climate models and we take the wind and the pressure fields from the global models, and actually that's done by Dan Kahan and very numerous partners at Scripps, and then that information gets brought over to us, and then we build these global and regional wind and wave models, which is that center moving panel. And then we, through a series of nested equations and modeling runs, we then bring it up onto shore. I won't get into too much of the detail on the science, just get into what we show with it. So for COSMOS, it's been going since about 2011. It started as a pilot project as part of the ARC storm scenario, and it started in Southern California. And then it moved up to the Bay Area, where it did some work on the outer coast of the Bay and then the Bay, and that was primarily funded by NOAA. We then came back down to the Southern California stretch from Point Conception to the U.S.-Mexico border. That was funded in two phases, the first phase by Coastal Conservancy and then the second phase by the Fourth Assessment. So thank you, Coastal Conservancy and CNRA and Becky. And then we're now in Central Coast, and this is where OPC comes in, and we're in the one-third of the phase of modeling the Central Coast and looking forward to being able to share that information with Tiffany when it gets done. And then final phase will be to go up to the North Coast. So this is... One of the things that I wanted to start doing was to relate how this information relates to the OPC guidance. So somewhere page 46 or so, no, I'm just kidding, there's this point here about coordinating and collaborating with local and state, et cetera. So one of the things that I think the reason that there's been so much state support for COSMOS is that it gives this consistent, regionally consistent methodology that is available almost throughout the entire state. So this is one way that communities, in one part of LA, the southern part of LA, can be looking at same type of information as Malibu, So it's a way that we can have a consistent data set that communities can use. So this helps kind of advance this point here. So with COSMOS, we have 40 possible scenarios. It goes from, we talk in meters, and actually this slide is wrong. For the Central Coast, we're going to be going up to 3 meters because of the H++ scenario. So we'll have 0 to 3 meters, generally quarter meter increments, but a little bit of variation there. And then we will still keep our catastrophic 5 meter scenario that we've had since really the beginning of all this. But then we have four different types of storm scenarios. So daily conditions where there is no storm, an average annual winter storm, a 20 year kind of mid-range storm, and then the whopper of the 100 year storm. And we consider a lot of different inputs into this, from rivers, storm surge, the waves, and we model everything to a spring tide, which isn't the king tide, but it's not the regular high tide. It's sort of in the middle. It happens about 6 times a month. And we have all of this. And so the combination of these 10 sea level rise scenarios with these four storms gives you 40 possible scenarios that you can explore. So if you look, we have partnered with Point Blue and have developed this viewer here that allows you to explore all of this information. So here's looking at Long Beach, another...
It's the same Southern California same. Community you previously
I know. Yes. I'm realizing that now. Thank you. Thanks.
So Pacoima doesn't really have a...
Not so much yet. No.
But
yeah.
We'll work on that.
See what happens with the West End. Okay. So here's looking just at... let's pick on the aquarium in the Pacific. Sorry, Jerry. And here we're just looking at zero sea level rise, zero storm. This is what it would look like with 1.75 meters, so about, on the fly, I can't do it, 4 feet maybe about sea level rise, four and a half feet of sea level rise. Two scientists in the room. Looking at just sea level rise and no storm, and then if you put the 100-year storm on top of it. So this is what Cosmos is about, right, is showing how if you're just thinking about sea level rise, you're clearly missing some of the vulnerability. So this gets to some of the points that are made, again, in the Ocean Protection Council, which is beyond just thinking about sea level rise, you want to also be thinking about storms. The other thing that you can do is look at what is vulnerable today. So this is looking at Carpinteria, and then we have Santa Barbara and Airport Goleta. This is looking at flood projections from the 100-year storm with no sea level rise. So I do want to say that the 100-year storm is a very catastrophic storm. We maybe have one on record. So this is not something that happens all the time. If you remember that picture of the pier in Ventura with the flag sticking out on the other side when there was that really big wave event, that was like a 10-year storm. So when we're talking 100-year storm, this is a massive storm. But what you're able to do is look at just the storm impact so that you can understand the vulnerability today. And this helps with thinking about emergency response, response to natural disasters. The other part that gets discussed a lot in the sea level rise guidance is this adaptive pathways approach, so looking at tipping points. So here's another stretch in Santa Barbara, again SoCal, but, another Central Cal, sorry. So looking at this stretch here in Santa Barbara, looking at just no sea level rise today, looking at half a meter of sea level rise, you start to see some vulnerability, and then at 1 meter of sea level rise, this is with no storm, you see this tipping point. So this is where you can start to get into these triggers and thinking about how you want to maybe plan for the future, because it's not all going to happen at once. It's going to happen at a certain rate. You can also look at it with flooding and storms. So again, here's looking at the 100-year storm with zero sea level rise, half a meter sea level rise with 1 meter of sea level rise. Again, you see that tipping point. So this gets to that point about developing adaptation pathways that increase resiliency. We also have projections of beach change. From the work that we did in Southern California, we were able to pull out some average statistics from this, where by 2100, we're looking at 31 to 60% of SoCal beaches being completely eroded, some of them eroding a lot, up to about 150 feet. And then we also have cliff retreat projections. The other really important thing that we try to provide, and the other viewers do this as well, but is to give some measure of the uncertainty in our projections, because there's lots of different places where things are going to be uncertain, both from the modeling and from the information that goes into it. And so what we try to show is sort of the minimum, where we got everything as right as we could, to where things sort of went, you know, potentially the uncertainty was greater, so that communities have this broad understanding of their entire risk. So from the most, this will get to the risk aversion concept that's discussed a lot in this, because different types of assets are going to require you to think about your risk in different ways. So this information is readily available. We want to be really transparent about this. The other component that comes along with the Cosmos information is a companion tool that looks at socioeconomic analysis, and we give information on people, employees, roads, and this gets into some of the social equity and the human side of the guidance, right? So ensuring that we're not displacing jobs and we're not impacting housing costs, and thinking about the social and economic implications of different adaptation strategies. And I noted before that a lot of the other viewers have this kind of socioeconomic information as well. So I'll close with this last point about the coordinating among the various agencies. And so we've been thinking about this for a long time. This is a cleaned up version of what a coastal community faces.
That's cleaned up.
Yeah. I know. You should have seen the whiteboard.
I'm glad I didn't see the other one. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was, you know, back in 2015. And this was work that was done with a lot of the state agencies, USCC grant, a bunch of different groups, because a lot of us on the ground were hearing from the coastal communities, you know, we've got to do this for this, and we've got to do this for this, and how do they match up? And so we've been thinking about a long time about how we can help coastal communities get to where they can align all of these products. And so a lot of the information that Louise gave gets to this, but it still sort of leaves, you know, communities feeling like this might have been your predecessor in Santa Cruz, and where we want them to go, right, is this euphoric with the organs and everything, where they feel like they're aligned. So there's a lot of work going on in this space beyond the ICARP and the clearinghouse and all of that. There was some work a few years ago that tried to show how all the different modeling information overlaps and doesn't overlap, and so that's being rebooted. It was lifting the fog. Now we're going to see the future. And then we're also trying to work with these various, all these agencies. We're actually meeting next week, and we're bringing Tiffany in so she can tell us how to do it, but to try to figure out how all these plans can be aligned. So that's sort of the next step of how we can take the science and the planning, and I'll bring it forward. And I think that's all I have. And thank you to all of these. Are the two top rows are all the funders that have supported us, and the bottom rows are the some of the Point Blue who's built the viewer, and then the researchers that have helped with us along the way. So thank you.
Thank you very much. In a moment, we're going to have questions, but somebody needs to bring me the speaker card so I can call on them. No, just bring them straight to me. Thank you. We have three, and I think, seeing no other mic, I guess we'll use the mic at the table. The first one is Jason Giffen, and on deck is Danielle Lynch. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Secretary Laird, members of the council. My name is Jason Giffen. I'm here on behalf of the Port of San Diego. I'd like to start by thanking the council and staff for taking some extra time for doing some extra public outreach, including the February 5th informational webinar, as well as arranging today's meeting. The Port of San Diego submitted a formal comment letter on this draft, and we've been engaged through the past year and an active participant as this guidance has been developed. As you already know, the Port of San Diego is unique in its diversity of both geography and uses. As a grantee of tidal and submerged lands around San Diego Bay, the port has a mission to protect and promote public trust uses, including commerce, navigation, fisheries, recreation, and environmental stewardship. These public trust uses are spread across a mixed-use bay, including water-dependent uses throughout our urban and dense working waterfront, marine terminals, fishing piers, harbors, hotels, restaurants, marinas, as well as open space and conservation areas. As a side note, it was insightful to hear about OPC's California Fishing Fund and Loan Program for small commercial fishing operations at your January meeting, which have had long-term homes in many of the state's ports and harbors. Because of our unique nature of these uses, we appreciate that ports are specifically mentioned in Recommendation Section 3, which acknowledges adaptation strategies should consider the unique characteristics, constraints, and values of existing water-dependent infrastructure, ports, and public trust uses. This allows us to utilize a guidance and best available science while considering future sea level rise projections, while still acknowledging that adaptation strategies should consider our unique characteristics so that we and all ports continue to be one of the state's primary economic and coastal resources while upholding our responsibilities under the Coastal Act as well as the public trust doctrine. I'd like to acknowledge one intent of the guidance is to suggest that agencies assess impacts from low, medium, and high projections. We understand that it is a valuable best practice to be thorough in these assessments, especially for disclosure purposes. That being said, thank you for considering the unique nature of ports like the Port of San Diego and the guidance, and for the extra engagement on the topic. We look forward to future collaboration with OPC as we use the guidance and as California ports continue to thrive, as well as our coastal and public lands and resources remain vibrant. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your comments. Then next is Danielle Lynch, and on deck is Michelle Jesperson.
Good afternoon, Chair Laird and members. Danielle Lynch here on behalf of, and myself,
Danielle Lynch on behalf of the Ocean Conservancy. I will be brief. You all should have seen our comments in December on the guidance language, along with a handful of stakeholders. I did just want to offer our strong support for the guidelines adoption. We believe that this is a huge improvement from the 2013 guidelines, thanks in large part to the new updated science that has allowed a much more thorough and comprehensive approach to strategies for climate adaptation and resilience. And we do look forward to continuing to work with the Council on implementation on the guidelines for the crossing our fingers adoption of the guidelines soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And then there's Michelle Jesperson.
Good afternoon, Chair Laird. Michelle Jesperson with the California Coastal Commission. I just wanted to offer some brief remarks. Commission staff supports the adoption of this final state sea level rise guidance, and we support many of the guiding principles and recommendations that are identified as they complement many of the Commission's agency's sea level rise interpretive guidelines that were passed and adopted by our commission in August of 2015. We are using this guidance actively in planning with local governments and in our project review. We feel that the steps outlined in this guidance are very complementary to step one of the commission's own sea level rise guidance. In particular, we support recommendations in the guidance to do some scenario-based planning. An evaluation of the low, medium, and high probabilistic projections. The recommendation to evaluate the high or extreme scenario is consistent with our approach to demonstrating an understanding and review of what the worst-case scenario might look like. We believe this is especially important as the state embarks on investments in critical infrastructure and transportation. We also appreciate the emphasis on evaluating adaptation options to sea level rise that are most protective of ecosystems, habitats, coastal resources, and public access. And we are glad to see the changes in line with our recommendations in our letter of December to better address environmental justice concerns, including support for more inclusive processes that allow for the needs and desires of traditionally underserved or disadvantaged communities to be heard in the sea level rise planning process. We very much appreciate the opportunity to coordinate and participate in the development and revisions to this guidance, and we look forward to implementing the recommendations in this guidance with our local governments and other state agency partners. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Now this is going to come to the council for questions, comments, and hopefully action. And let me just ask one to kick off while other people are deciding what questions they want to ask. And I'll do it for Dr. Kopp. And the tough thing in all this is that I know that Dr. Finzihart made a reference to uncertainty and projections when she was talking about one of her things. And you talked about all the probabilistic pieces of this. How do you balance the fact that you're so trying to be true to the science that we have to deliver a message that this is happening, and the question is only how much? How do you balance that so that the message is still clear in all this?
Well, I think one of the advantages of a probabilistic approach or of quantifying your uncertainty, which is a hallmark of good science, is that it allows you to say...
But it is crazy-making to policymakers.
Yes, I understand.
Just for the record, it is crazy-making to quantifying the uncertainty. Great, let's take action because we've quantified the uncertainty.
It allows you to say what you know with a high degree of confidence. Right? We know what the 2050 projections are reasonably well, and we can put a minimum... 95% probable minimum on that, and we can look at what that's not likely to exceed, and we can also identify the areas where, frankly, there's quite a lot of uncertainty, and therefore you require a decision framework that doesn't depend upon one number, that's willing to be flexible and involve adaptation pathways, and looking at, it's more honest to say, here's a range of things that science might reveal to us in the future, and you need to be ready to act as that resolves, and it is to say, here is the number for 2100 that could be, that will change when another study comes out next year. And I think that the inclusion of the flexible adaptation pathways is sort of a key to dealing with that deeper level of uncertainty.
But it seems to me that in the messaging,
yeah,
what you're trying to do is saying there's a range, but there's a certainty. It's just a range of what will happen,
yeah,
within that certainty. And I just get worried that it gets explained on the flip side a lot of times. So that if there were people hungry to figure out why this might not be happening or might not be happening at a level that they should be concerned, we give them an opening for that when that is not what the science is saying.
All right. So if you know something is a possibility, for instance, you know you might get sick tomorrow, but it's not likely, you still tend to buy insurance, right? It's your reaction, the approach to saying something is uncertain is not to say, therefore you ignore it, it's to say you manage the risk, right? And saying something is uncertain, therefore you shouldn't take action to address it is just not, you know, that you wouldn't do that in any realistic
context.
I
think the difference is,
yeah,
is that based on your different scenarios, this is happening.
Yes.
It's a question of in what range,
yes,
given emission scenarios
whatever. And for some levels, it's just a question of when. Right? I mean, there will be 2 feet, there will be 3 feet, there will be 4 feet of sea level rise along the coast. The question is when that's going to take place.
That's the clarity,
yes,
I am looking for. Took a while. Mr. Stone, this is the time for questions.
Yeah, thank you. But that's also why I appreciate in this guidance this notion of adaptation pathways, because it's very important as we are encouraging decisions at local governments and other agencies about how they figure out how they're going to answer these questions or solve these problems with their own constituencies. They're still responsible to that ultimate question of you're making a risk assessment decision, but what happens if it's greater? They still have to address that in the conversation, and that's where I think this guidance and the flexibility or the requirement to talk about all the potential outcomes is really ultimately important. But Dr. Wise-West, I want to ask a pointed question. Santa Cruz is doing a lot. How does the City of Santa Cruz fund all that it's doing? And I need you to use the microphone so it's on the record.
So really, our vulnerability assessment was $20,000. That was something that each of the departments contributed to. Everything else that we've done, I've done, or have done with community partners. We have been actively searching for grants. We haven't landed any yet on the planning side. We have on the implementation side in terms of some of the work we're doing in the San Lorenzo River. But the work that we're doing largely comes through the Climate Action Program's budget and through, you know, the work that I do with 9 interns. That's really how it happens. That's why it's so important that we get, you know, we were very limited in what we could do with our adaptation plan update because of the lack of dollars, and I'm very actively seeking grants so that we can do some of these next step things to characterize, well, what's the contribution of climate change to precipitation and runoff in the San Lorenzo River? The maps that I showed you don't include that, so we know we're under-projecting in that area. How do we set up the monitoring triggers and thresholds, that kind of thing? There's going to need to be funding. And again, that's why I'm really encouraged to see a lot of grant opportunities out right now. I'm working on a number of proposals as we speak, and future grant opportunities. I should also acknowledge I do a lot of collaboration from state to regional to sub-regional, and I think that's crucially important to learn from what other folks are doing, learn what USGS is doing, and, you know, we talk very regularly now, and it's all benefiting Santa Cruz and our climate adaptation plan. So I think that cross-collaboration, coordination, and the communication is crucially important because there aren't a lot of, you know, our planners don't have experience in this work. I didn't have experience in this work before starting it a year and a half ago. I was, you know, mostly doing emissions mitigation and renewable energy. And so, you know, we need to have that kind of those supportive structures and the dollars.
And that was a leading question to get you there, because the thing that we can't underestimate is the cost of this.
Yes.
Now, Santa Cruz has the political will and has been working on this line for 12 to 15 years, building towards this point. And they have the political will to look ahead and want to do this. But if we're going to expect all communities to be participating, look at their vulnerabilities, we have to figure out how we fund this up and down the coast. And, well, and there are a lot of questions come inland. And I'm glad you raised that. We're talking about storm and storm surge from the ocean side, but you also have to add in the amount of water coming from the land side down.
Right.
And when they meet in areas low, like in your case, the San Lorenzo River, but there are plenty of places up and down the coast, you're adding to the vulnerabilities as well.
Exactly.
And the flood maps and what to expect need to be very clear. And having these conversations in our communities, pointing out the vulnerabilities, drawing these maps to show what one little increment, next little increment, who's being affected, what those potentials are. You know, imagine drawing lines in your community showing if this was the event, you would be underwater now.
Right.
Those are really critical. And I just have to point out that in the demographic pie chart that you put up, there was one slice that was part of the outreach that were surfers.
That's right.
Because this is Santa Cruz, and it was not the smallest slice, I will point out. So, but thank you for that work. But this is something that we all have to think about with the state setting the guidance here. Local communities through coastal and others are having these conversations, but it's a very expensive proposition, and you're changing land use decisions, which now over the next 20 years, communities will be making land use decisions that will in fact affect the second half of this century. So all of these things need to be put together, and the money for planning, the money for doing the hard work up front, then let alone moving the infrastructure and affecting the land decisions, is something that's going to be, that's a big task that we still have yet to answer those questions.
Absolutely.
So thank you for bringing that perspective, and I'm glad Santa Cruz, and there are other communities that are looking at this as well. But I knew what Santa Cruz has done, they've been at it for quite a while, and it's great to see the sophistication of the conversation that you're putting out there.
Thank you very much.
There's also real sophistication about where the surfers park near Lighthouse Field.
Yeah.
They're in about three lots, and the older surfers park in one particular lot, and the other surfers refer to them as the carp. So we got to make sure that if any of you come to Santa Cruz, you're not caught in the carp lot.
Thank you.
Senator Hertz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know who I direct this to, but this is the Oceans Protection Council. This report is about the impact of the ocean on the land. What I'm interested in addition, because our obligation is to protect the ocean, we're taking the human side of the trade. Our job is to protect the ocean. What's the impact of the rise on the ocean? What are we doing for that? How do we fund that? At the end of the day, we're talking about sea life and all the other aspects of what the ocean's about, and particularly with the Lands Commission, all the other elements of the jurisdiction of the ocean. And I only say that just as an advertisement, because I've got a bill on that particular issue that will create a revenue stream for protecting the ocean. And it's, you know, it's hard because, you know, we look at these challenges, and the chairman made the point, and I think it's quite insightful. It's the great challenge that policymakers always have, whatever the urgency of the day is. I had a hearing last year on trees. No one paid a rat's bit of attention to it as chairman of Natural Resources and Water. Today, trees become a lot more important as we had these extraordinary fires that we all had to deal with. Tomorrow, it may be earthquakes or something else. And so the challenge we always have in this country, where, you know, so often it's whatever the urgency of the day is that then informs decision makers, the results of what decision makers do, is how do you create the long-term think? Certainly this has been part of it. I was part of the Governor Schwarzenegger's task force some 9 years ago that started out as Pacific Council when we did the exact same thing. Of course, none of it's reported in here because no one remembers history. It's too long ago, but that's okay. I'm used to that coming back. But I only share that because this Rigs to Reef program that Speaker Perez did and that we're trying to change, the administration's been very deeply involved in it, basically is somewhat controversial, but creates some revenue stream where if we take down these oil rigs and any savings that we have, a large percentage from 65% to 85% of that money goes into a fund which this body administers. This body administers after it's determined by this body that there's a net environmental benefit. And in my estimation, this could be as much as $5 billion, which could then be used to protect the ocean, which is our job. So I only point that out because we often look at the human side and not ultimately what our job here is, to protect the oceans and how do we get a revenue stream in view of all the competing interests. And if we were to be able to do something like that, that was a net environmental benefit, it would be a good thing for all of us. I only want to point that out because the report doesn't really deal with that. And all the discussion around this adaptation is, oh my God, what do we do when, you know, the people in the big rich cities lose their big fancy houses and, you know, the people in Pacoima become beachfront property.
Other questions or comments? And Betty.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to all the presenters today. And I know this is a culmination of a lot of work and certainly a lot of outreach and a lot of stakeholder engagement on this as well. I think to your point, Mr. Chairman, about how do we get constituencies to really, you know, kind of grasp what's to come. And to me, and I just want to give on behalf of the State Lands Commission and the ports just our tremendous gratitude for including adaptation strategies for water-dependent infrastructure and ports and public trust uses and prioritizing those because of their unique characteristics and constraints. I mean, ports can't do a lot. They can't pick up and move inland, and there are just a lot of unique circumstances around that. But I think what's missing here and what can help with respect to the constituency engagement around this is economic impact. I mean, there are economic activities associated, certainly, with the ports, and, you know, certainly that's our jurisdiction. The State Lands Commission is to create that balance, find that balance between protection and sustainability of our public trust resources and lands and the economic activities on those. And but I think by dealing with the economic factors, and I think what we're going to see the ports really focus on is exactly that, it becomes a little bit more real. And I think becomes more tangible with respect to what's in store for us on this front. So just want to, again, applaud you for your leadership on this, certainly including those aspects of it. And I think this is, as Jen Eckerle said, this is a great first step. It's a critical first step, and more to come. And also am very appreciative that the current planning efforts that are underway be allowed to proceed, and I think those will continue to inform how we continue to speak about this on some more tangible terms as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Secretary Rodriguez.
Well, thank you, Secretary Laird. And I want to echo the comments by the other members of the council here on my appreciation for all the work that's gone into this. It's a very, very nice document, just very well produced. A lot of thought has obviously gone into it. What I'd like to see next, and what I'd like to ask the staff to think about next, is coming back to us with a discussion of, okay, how do we get this implemented? And what are the obstacles to implementation? You know, one of the things I can say is that my office is littered with, quite literally, guidelines and things that have been produced in the past but didn't live to the implementation stage or got forgotten. And so what will it take to implement these ideas? And part of that goes into looking at what are the obstacles to implementation. I think we've identified a couple of them here. A large one is cost. What's going to take to really implement this? How do we get buy-in from communities? So we need to give that some thought. I will say that having spent a large amount of my time representing the Coastal Commission through the years, I understand the analogy to health and buying health insurance. But I can tell you there are a lot of people who live in the proximity of the coast who
are willing to live with the risk and hope they just don't get sick. And so how do we get through to those folks? How do we convince them that really, no, this is a serious problem, and it goes to the issue that Secretary Laird was raising, that they really need to pay attention to this and we need to do something about it. And then there's the issue of, you know, planned retreat sounds nice. What about those areas in the coastal zone where there's no room for retreat, or it doesn't appear that there is? What are we going to do in those areas? So I think we just need to give some thought to, okay, this makes sense. This is a document that we want to implement. We want to see it work. But how are we going to get it implemented, and how are we going to overcome some of the obstacles to implementation that are out there that will get in the way of providing the resilience in the coast that we need? So, you know, if we could talk about that at a future meeting, I think that'd be helpful.
Before I ask for a motion, let me ask if Michael in Santa Barbara has a question or a comment.
I do. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and so can everybody else.
Thank you very much, Secretary Laird, for the opportunity to talk, even if I am invisible to all of you. And
you're sort of fading in and out somehow, and I don't know if you need to talk right next to something all the time.
Try to move my microphone.
That's perfect.
Much closer.
That's perfect.
How's that?
Let it rip.
Okay. So I'll join my colleagues on the council to thank both the staff and all the speakers for just great work on the guidance document, terrific presentations. I think I hit the trifecta of growing up in Los Angeles and recognizing most of the LA shots, like Secretary Laird spending 4 years in Santa Cruz and recognizing those. And now living in Santa Barbara, some of those hit very close to home. And actually, I even have a connection to New Jersey, believe it or not.
Speed it up, Michael.
Okay. So here's my question. The infrastructure in a number of coastal communities that is not only the port dependent or such as ocean dependent, such as ports on Santa Barbara harbors, there's various both commercial and recreational activities, is the infrastructure of sewage treatment plants and other public sector kinds of built out facilities that, as was noted by Secretary Rodriguez, can't be really difficult to move somewhere. And the impact, as Senator Hertzberg noted, on the ocean of some of these facilities, such as sewage treatment plants under a sea level rise and storm-related view or combination scenario, is really significant. And my fear is that communities, partly because of cost, but also partly like where are these facilities going to go, are really going to be sort of paralyzed as to trying to do something about it. And one of the more significant things that potentially I would fear happening is that there would be an effort to try to armor the coast in an effort to protect this public infrastructure. So I think there are a kind of a number of issues that both the council and the policymakers in the legislature and the governor's office should start thinking about, and about both not only the impacts of sea level rise on humans, as Senator Hertzberg said, but the impacts on the marine environment. And then I want to make one comment that I think is, which I have already made to Deborah, that there's a lot of benefit for going out for the council itself to go out into communities and do a roadshow to explain the guidance. I don't think we should just rely on communities trying to understand this guidance by themselves. Thanks.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments, and they sort of dovetail with Secretary Rodriguez's. So let me suggest a motion. And the motion would be that we approve this guidance and we direct the staff to return to us at the next meeting about whatever implementation steps they think we need to take. So does somebody wish to move that? Motion by Rodriguez. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by the Ethernet, Mike Brown. Are there further comments to the motion?
Mr. Chairman, I want to just echo Secretary Rodriguez's point about, it's implementation steps, but it really is identifying specific obstacles, because I think with implementation of any of these things, we kind of run into some patterns about some common things that seem to make sense in terms of near-term attention that should be drawn to, particularly how we may want to do this next stage of outreach, how we continue to work in partnership, how we remain cognizant of other planning efforts that are taking place. I mean, I think those might be things that could aid our implementation, or they could be obstacles as well.
I think that's exactly right, yeah. And I think the suggestion that this come back to us allows us to make sure all that is in front of us and we can identify it and ask the questions. Further discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Let me thank everybody for the work on this. Haven't received any requests for public comment on non-agenda items. The next meeting, the staff is shooting for April 24th, 1 to 4, in the Natural Resources Auditorium. And right on the dot, we will stand adjourned. Thank you very much.